Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
I was not a great pupil. I was dyslexic. I am dyslexic.
But didn't know at the time?
At the time, no. They just thought I was just being lazy. My mom didn't think I was just being lazy. She just didn't. She said, I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's okay. And so she didn't allow people to call me stupid or any of the words that lots of people had to deal with. I know I'm talking a lot about my mom, but I was very blessed to have the woman that I had as a mother because she was just odd enough to recognize the oddity in her child. And that was kind of groovy.
Extract 1.
Yes, she was. But and the next wonderful thing she did for me, that when I finally went to school at 7, it was a horrible, really rough school. And I was being bullied terribly because my mother made me knickers that were made from the end of the material that whatever she was working on for somebody, she would not buy me lovely navy knickers. And so the children very early on, because I had very short dresses, noticed that I had these exotic knickers on.
Made from offcuts.
Oh, they made, you know, it was awful. And I said, I'm not going anymore.
Extract 2.
When you went for that audition at RADA, did you feel prepared? What sort of roles had you played?
In that sense, I hadn't. But they RADA gave you a list of speeches that you could use. Right. You could pick your own. I think I had to do 2 auditions.
Expensive thing to do. But you say you got a scholarship.
I did, yes. RADA wrote to me and said, if they'd had a scholarship, they would have given it to me. But as they didn't, they were sorry they couldn't. And I related this to the management of Boots Cash Chemist that I was working with. And the manager wrote to my local council, Cheshire County Council, and said, I had the opportunity for this scholarship. Would they pay? And they did.
That's a very generous thing for him to do then, isn't it?
I mean, extremely generous.
He was losing his
Well,
his
I wasn't
worker.
The only one. And I was hardly the star of the show there, I can tell you. But the amazing thing was that the local authority were prepared to listen and actually fund me the money. Wouldn't happen today.
Extract 3.
How far do you think can we see the legacy of those legal studies at Oxford in your films, particularly in that pursuit of social justice?
I think it comes from somewhere else. Yeah. When I was at university, I wasn't particularly political. The thing I did see at Oxford was wealth. I mean, I'd done national service 2 years in the RAF before I went to university. And that was an education, being in a billet with 21 other lads. There were people who were really poor there. And I went from that to Oxford, and my God, people were rich there. It was 1950s, late 1950s. So it was a lot closer to Brideshead Revisited than it is now. And there were people there who knew they would rule the world, had a sense of entitlement that was extraordinary. And there were certain colleges where almost entirely public school. And seeing this wealth on parade and the casual ease with which people lived a wholly different life. I mean, that's what stayed with me at Oxford.
Extract 4.
Well, I do remember a careers talk given to us when we were about to sit our O-levels, which was actually unbelievably given by the head of English, which was about knuckling down and doing manual jobs. I remember he kept repeating the phrase about there are too many people in this country afraid to get their hands dirty. And then the head of woodwork came out and offered up the kind of the apotheosis of our ambition as being taken on as an apprentice at a hardware shop in the high street. The hardware shop no longer exists. It's a Wetherspoons now. But it felt a very odd kind of presentation. And I think if you were academically strong enough, and I was very fortunate that I was, the way out was to look at the professions and secure employment.
Extract 5.
And I never got a single job. I'd always get to like the last two or three, and never got a single part until I was 17.
But undeterred, though?
Oh, undeterred completely, because I just didn't think I had a choice. My dad tells a story of going to audition for the Sound of Music at Sadler's Wells, and you'd get there at the start of the day and there would be hundreds of kids. And God bless my dad. I realise now as a parent how utterly annoying that would be on a Saturday, to drive up to London at 8 a.m. to be there at 9. And essentially you would start by singing a song, and then they would just start cutting people throughout the day. Every half an hour, they would just, if they read your name, thank you so much, this has been amazing, you can go home.
Extract 6.
In the beginning.
His big breakthrough show was Kush. Mm-hmm. You saw that in Delhi then. Was that the first time, the first production that you'd seen of his company?
Yeah, the first time I saw him kind of do what he does was in New Delhi with Kush. And I think I was probably about 20, and it just blew my mind, opened my eyes to something I'd never seen before. I mean, I can't remember the full synopsis of Kush, but I just remember the movement. I just remember the way his and his company members, dancers, you know, bodies were moving. There was something beyond genre about the way they moved, where I could simultaneously see the roots of what he was doing, but also it wasn't just a kind of splice of two things. It was becoming something else entirely. And watching that happen with a body, you know, watching what was possible and seeing this whole new world happen within a body, it just did something really primal for me. Like, I just saw what was possible. I just saw how you could take from your roots and then exist in a way that was really authentic and true to who you are as well.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract zero.
I was not a great pupil. I was dyslexic. I am dyslexic.
But didn't know at the time?
At the time, no. They just thought I was just being lazy. My mom didn't think I was just being lazy. She just didn't. She said, I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's okay. And so she didn't allow people to call me stupid or any of the words that lots of people had to deal with. I know I'm talking a lot about my mom, but I was very blessed to have the woman that I had as a mother because she was just odd enough to recognize the oddity in her child. And that was kind of groovy.
Extract one.
Yes, she was. And the next wonderful thing she did for me, that when I finally went to school at seven, it was a horrible, really rough school. And I was being bullied terribly because my mother made me knickers that were made from the end of the material that whatever she was working on for somebody, she would not buy me lovely navy knickers. And so the children very early on, because I had very short dresses, noticed that I had these exotic knickers on.
Made from offcuts.
Oh, they made away. They, you know, it was awful. And I said, I'm not going anymore.
Extract two.
When you went for that audition at RADA, did you feel prepared? What sort of roles had you played?
In that sense, I hadn't. But RADA gave you a list of speeches that you could use. Right. You could pick your own. I think I had to do two auditions.
Expensive thing to do. But you say you got a scholarship.
I did, yes. RADA wrote to me and said, if they'd had a scholarship, they would have given it to me. But as they didn't, they were sorry they couldn't. And I related this to the management of Boots Cash Chemist that I was working with. And the manager wrote to my local council, Cheshire County Council, and said, I had the opportunity for this scholarship. Would they pay? And they did.
That's a very generous thing for him to do then, isn't it? I mean,
extremely generous.
He was losing his
Well,
his
I wasn't
worker.
The only one. And I was hardly the star of the show there, I can tell you. But the amazing thing was that the local authority were prepared to listen and actually fund me the money. Wouldn't happen today.
Extract three.
How far do you think can we see the legacy of those legal studies at Oxford in your films, particularly in that pursuit of social justice?
I think it comes from somewhere else. Yeah. When I was at university, I wasn't particularly political. The thing I did see at Oxford was wealth. I mean, I'd done national service 2 years in the RAF before I went to university, and that was an education, being in a billet with 21 other lads. There were people who were really poor there. And I went from that to Oxford, and my God, people were rich there. It was 1950s, late 1950s, so it was a lot closer to Brideshead Revisited than it is now. And there were people there who knew they would rule the world, had a sense of entitlement that was extraordinary. And there were certain colleges where almost entirely public school, and seeing this wealth on parade and the casual ease with which people lived a wholly different life. I mean, that's what stayed with me at Oxford.
Extract four.
Well, I do remember a careers talk given to us when we were about to sit our O-levels, which was actually unbelievably given by the head of English, which was about knuckling down and doing manual jobs. I remember he kept repeating the phrase about there are too many people in this country afraid to get their hands dirty. And then the head of woodwork came out and offered up the kind of the apotheosis of our ambition as being taken on as an apprentice at a hardware shop in the high street. The hardware shop no longer exists. It's a Wetherspoons now. But it felt a very odd kind of presentation. And I think if you were academically strong enough, and I was very fortunate that I was, the way out was to look at the professions and secure employment.
Extract 5.
And I never got a single job. I'd always get to like the last two or three and never got a single part until I was 17.
But undeterred, though?
Oh, undeterred completely, because I just didn't think I had a choice. My dad tells a story of going to audition for the Sound of Music at Sadler's Wells, and you'd get there at the start of the day and there would be hundreds of kids. And God bless my dad. I realise now as a parent how utterly annoying that would be on a Saturday to drive up to London at 8 a.m. to be there at 9. And essentially you would start by singing a song and then they would just start cutting people throughout the day. Every half an hour they would just, if they read your name, thank you so much, this has been amazing, you can go home.
Extract 6.
In the beginning.
His big breakthrough show was Kash. Mm-hmm. You saw that in Delhi then. Was that the first time, the first production that you'd seen of his company?
Yeah, the first time I saw him kind of do what he does was in New Delhi with Kash. And I think I was probably about 20, and it just blew my mind, opened my eyes to something I'd never seen before. I mean, I can't remember the full synopsis of Kash, but I just remember the movement. I just remember the way his and his company members, dancers, you know, bodies were moving. There was something beyond genre about the way they moved, where I could simultaneously see the roots of what he was doing, but also it wasn't just a kind of splice of two things. It was becoming something else entirely. And watching that happen with body, you know, watching what was possible and seeing this whole new world happen within a body, it just did something really primal for me. Like, I just saw what was possible. I just saw how you could take from your roots and then exist in a way that was really authentic and true to who you are as well.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract zero.
Boston and New York are famed for their rivalries. Everything from the Yankees versus the Red Sox to who makes the correct clam chowder. It seems even the local wildlife has hometown pride, because pigeons that roost near Rockefeller Center are genetically distinct from those that summer at the Cape. The finding is in the journal Evolutionary Applications.
Extract 1.
I don't think we could be in a city without thinking about pigeons. And for many people, it's one of the few daily interactions that they have with wildlife.
Elizabeth Carlin, a graduate student at Fordham University in the Bronx.
Extract 2.
As an evolutionary biologist, Carlin was curious about whether pigeons in one city are closely related, genetically speaking, to those from cities nearby. So she did a research-inspired road trip, making stops from Boston to D.C.
Extract 3.
I would drive to a city and then start talking to people at Starbucks, anybody that I could chat with. I would start asking them questions about where they saw pigeons and kind of start to gather intel that way.
Extract 4.
Once she'd found a flock, she'd lay down some birdseed.
And then use a net gun, which is basically something that looks like a big flashlight, and it shoots a net out over the pigeons.
Extract 5.
With birds literally in hand, she would take a DNA sample.
I like to call it like a pigeon 23andMe, right? We're looking for ancestry and proportion of shared ancestry. And so we can build this big map with all these individuals that kind of tells us who's more closely related to who.
Extract 6.
Carlin was surprised to find that pigeons in the Northeast can be divided into two distinct populations.
One population is in Boston and Providence, and then the other population ranges from New York down to Washington, D.C. I had actually, based on previous research, thought that pigeons in each city would form their own separate populations, because if you have food and you have mates, why would you go anywhere? Why would you disperse? And what I'm starting to realize is that pigeons actually kind of view this northeastern megacity as one giant city, at least from Boston down to Washington, D.C.
Extract 7.
And it wouldn't take much to promote avian intermixing within this megacity.
One pigeon will leave New York and go down to Philly, and then maybe a pigeon from Baltimore will come up to Philly, and that's allowing there to be gene flow between all these different cities.
Extract 8.
Maybe the feathered foragers are simply following the food. Just think of all the French fries left behind at rest stops along I-95.
Extract 9.
If humans are traveling this corridor quite a bit, it makes sense that pigeons also are traveling it.
As to why pigeons don't bother making the trip between Boston and New York, Carlin points to the more manicured lawns of Connecticut.
Connecticut is a lot more suburban than these other areas, and that might be why pigeons in Providence and Boston are kind of falling out as separate from pigeons in more southern cities.
Extract 10.
Next up, Carlin says she'd like to further explore the relationships that exist within flocks.
Are they aunts and uncles and cousins and parents and grandparents? Or are they just a random group of individuals that happen to come together?
Hopefully, not in the middle of the road.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Boston and New York are famed for their rivalries. Everything from the Yankees versus the Red Sox to who makes the correct clam chowder. It seems even the local wildlife has hometown pride, because pigeons that roost near Rockefeller Center are genetically distinct from those that summer at the Cape. The finding is in the journal Evolutionary Applications.
Extract 1.
I don't think we could be in a city without thinking about pigeons. And for many people, it's one of the few daily interactions that they have with wildlife.
Elizabeth Carlin, a graduate student at Fordham University in the Bronx.
Extract 2.
As an evolutionary biologist, Carlin was curious about whether pigeons in one city are closely related, genetically speaking, to those from cities nearby. So she did a research-inspired road trip, making stops from Boston to D.C.
Extract 3.
I would drive to a city and then start talking to people at Starbucks. Anybody that I could chat with, I would start asking them questions about where they saw pigeons and kind of start to gather intel that way.
Extract 4.
Once she'd found a flock, she'd lay down some birdseed.
And then use a net gun, which is basically something that looks like a big flashlight, and it shoots a net out over the pigeons.
Extract 5.
With birds literally in hand, she would take a DNA sample.
I like to call it like a pigeon 23andMe, right? We're looking for ancestry and proportion of shared ancestry. And so we can build this big map with all these individuals that kind of tells us who's more closely related to who.
Extract 6.
Carlin was surprised to find that pigeons in the Northeast can be divided into two distinct populations.
One population is in Boston and Providence, and then the other population ranges from New York down to Washington, D.C. I had actually, based on previous research, thought that pigeons in each city would form their own separate populations, because if you have food and you have mates, why would you go anywhere? Why would you disperse? And what I'm starting to realize is that pigeons actually kind of view this northeastern megacity as one giant city, at least from Boston down to Washington, D.C.
Extract 7.
And it wouldn't take much to promote avian intermixing within this megacity.
One pigeon will leave New York and go down to Philly, and then maybe a pigeon from Baltimore will come up to Philly, and that's allowing there to be gene flow between all these different cities.
Extract 8.
Maybe the feathered foragers are simply following the food. Just think of all the French fries left behind at rest stops along I-95.
Extract 9.
If humans are traveling this corridor quite a bit, it makes sense that pigeons also are traveling it.
As to why pigeons don't bother making the trip between Boston and New York, Carlin points to the more manicured lawns of Connecticut.
Connecticut is a lot more suburban than these other areas, and that might be why pigeons in Providence and Boston are kind of falling out as separate from pigeons in more southern cities.
Extract 10.
Next up, Carlin says she'd like to further explore the relationships that exist within flocks.
Are they aunts and uncles and cousins and parents and grandparents? Or are they just a random group of individuals that happen to come together?
Hopefully, not in the middle of the road.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Our painting is a miniature. It's been dated to around 1610. The miniature is about the size of the cover of a hardback book. It shows us a landscape, and in the centre is the encounter between the holy man and the prince. The holy man is on the left, grey-haired and bearded, and wearing a simple robe, cloak and turban. He is sitting on the ground, and beside him is a forked stick, the distinctive armrest or crutch of the dervish, the Islamic holy man. Kneeling in front of him is a young man wearing a purple costume covered with gold embroidery, with a jewelled dagger at his waist and a green turban with a feather. Contemporary sources tell us that a green turban is a sign of high status, and that a dagger like this one was obligatory for a noble. This is clearly a rich young man. The two figures, the ascetic dervish and the lavishly dressed prince, are shown on a slightly raised platform in front of a domed pavilion. It's clearly an Islamic shrine, built around the tomb of some revered religious figure. A delicately painted tree overshadows the central figures. At its base is a solitary blue iris, and behind, a rolling landscape disappears into the distance. In Mughal painting, landscape is often every bit as important as the figures. The Mughals were famous for their ornamental gardens, which were not merely places of pleasure, but also physical metaphors for the Islamic paradise. So this is an appropriate setting for our rich young man to be discussing belief with a Muslim teacher. In this idyllic setting, power has met piety, and they're in debate. In attendance on the prince are horses and colourfully dressed courtiers. More surprisingly, below the Muslim dervish crouches a half-naked man wearing white headgear, who could be a fakir or an ascetic, perhaps a follower of the dervish, but who, very intriguingly, since he's not wearing a turban, could also be a Hindu holy man. It's almost impossible to imagine a European ruler at this date, or indeed at any date, being represented so submissively taking instruction in faith. And in spite of all the political upheavals in India since the time of Jahangir, this tradition of the state accommodating all religions with equal respect was to endure, and was to become one of the founding ideals of modern India.
Dispone ahora de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Our painting is a miniature. It's been dated to around 1610. The miniature is about the size of the cover of a hardback book. It shows us a landscape, and in the centre is the encounter between the holy man and the prince. The holy man is on the left, grey-haired and bearded, and wearing a simple robe, cloak and turban. He's sitting on the ground, and beside him is a forked stick, the distinctive armrest or crutch of the dervish, the Islamic holy man. Kneeling in front of him is a young man wearing a purple costume covered with gold embroidery, with a jewelled dagger at his waist and a green turban with a feather. Contemporary sources tell us that a green turban is a sign of high status, and that a dagger like this one was obligatory for a noble. This is clearly a rich young man. The two figures, the ascetic dervish and the lavishly dressed prince, are shown on a slightly raised platform in front of a domed pavilion. It's clearly an Islamic shrine, built around the tomb of some revered religious figure. A delicately painted tree overshadows the central figures. At its base is a solitary blue iris, and behind, a rolling landscape disappears into the distance. In Mughal painting, landscape is often every bit as important as the figures. The Mughals were famous for their ornamental gardens, which were not merely places of pleasure, but also physical metaphors for the Islamic paradise. So this is an appropriate setting for our rich young man to be discussing belief with a Muslim teacher. In this idyllic setting, power has met piety, and they're in debate. In attendance on the prince are horses and colourfully dressed courtiers. More surprisingly, below the Muslim dervish crouches a half-naked man wearing white headgear, who could be a fakir or an ascetic, perhaps a follower of the dervish, but who, very intriguingly, since he's not wearing a turban, could also be a Hindu holy man. It's almost impossible to imagine a European ruler at this date, or indeed at any date, being represented so submissively taking instruction in faith. And in spite of all the political upheavals in India since the time of Jahangir, this tradition of the state accommodating all religions with equal respect was to endure, and was to become one of the founding ideals of modern India.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.